I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. The House committee investigating the January 6 attack on the Capitol held their fifth hearing yesterday, outlining the strong-arm tactics that former President Trump used on top members of the Justice Department to illegally overturn the results of the 2020 election so Trump could hold on to power. The witnesses, former Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen, former Acting Deputy Attorney General Richard Donahue, and former Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel Stephen Engel, all Trump appointees, described their refusal to participate in Trump's relentless campaign to interfere in the election. That included using false claims of voter fraud, seizing voting machines, outlandish allegations involving Italian satellites changing votes, and an attempt to install a new Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Clark to carry out Trump's bidding. They threatened they would resign if Clark got the job at a showdown meeting at the White House on January 3rd. Trump did back down, but we came perilously close to a coup. We learned this week that the FBI carried out a pre-dawn raid on Clark's house Wednesday morning, seizing electronic devices. Well, today on Radio Times, we'll play excerpts from yesterday's hearing, talk about what we learned, whether crimes were committed, and what it all means. And we have two guests who have joined us. Devlin Barrett is national security reporter for The Washington Post and joins us on Radio Times. Devlin Barrett, nice to have you with us on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Claire Finkelstein, professor of national security law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also founder and director of the School Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. Claire Finkelstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much, Marty.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, as always on Radio Times, we do want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Devlin, since you've been covering these hearings, what was the significance, would you say, of yesterday's hearing?
I think it's twofold, really. One, I think it's just very powerful to hear former Trump officials say in their own words, with their own emotions, frankly, how outlandish and disturbing these efforts were by Trump to sort of bend the Justice Department to his will. And two, I think we did get a little better understanding, despite all the details of this that have already been out there, about the degree to which Trump simply refused to take no for an answer, and the degree to which other individuals, admittedly a small number in Trump's, but they were very like well-connected folks, and were, you know, willing to do pretty much anything to try to make this scheme come to life.
And Claire, you know, some of this, as Devlin said, is not new, but we heard in their own words, these are former members of the Justice Department, how the president tried to use the Justice Department to his own ends. Speak to that.
It was really extraordinary, the testimony yesterday. I think it was, of all of the hearings that we've had so far, the most impactful, because to hear Trump loyalists who had been absolutely committed to this man, to this president, talk in very factual terms about the pressure they were under and the way that Donald Trump was absolutely intent on using the Justice Department to overturn this election by hook or by crook, and the degree to which they stood up to him and basically said, we will all resign if you proceed with this plan. Just how close it came was really extraordinary to hear.
And close it came to a coup. I said that in my introduction. I hesitated before using that word, but when you put it all together, Claire, it seems like we were close to that.
Well, I think that's right, because had the Justice Department gotten on board with this big lie, that would have been an absolute game changer. There would have been no resistance left in the system. So I think it was really the fact that Bill Barr stepped down, that members of the senior leadership of the Justice Department put their feet down and said, we are not going to tolerate this. If you put someone in there who is not qualified for the job and whose only purpose is to help you overturn the results of the election, we're not on board. Had that gone the other way, that would have been a completely different story.
Let me play a clip from yesterday's hearing, and this is a video from former Attorney General Bill Barr from his deposition. He is asked why he even had the Department of Justice investigate these outlandish allegations of election fraud, and this is what he said.
Felt the responsible thing to do was to be in a position to have a view as to whether or not there was fraud. And frankly, I think the fact that I put myself in the position that I could say that we had looked at this and didn't think there was fraud was really important to moving things forward. And I sort of shudder to think what the situation would have been if the position of the department was, we're not even looking at this until after Biden's in office. I'm not sure we would have had a transition at all.
That's really worrisome. Devlin Barr said three times he told former President Trump that there was no evidence of election fraud that would have in any way overturned the results of the election.
Yeah, and Barr is a very unique character in this time period because Attorney General Barr spent a good chunk of the run-up to the election essentially promoting the idea that there could or would likely be massive voter fraud based on the number of essentially pandemic measures to allow for expanded mail voting. But then he takes a hard turn after the election and basically by late November is saying very emphatically to the president, it's just not true that there was mass fraud. I think one of the ways in which 2020 was a very jarring and difficult process for a lot of the folks in government to get through is the degree to which people in the Trump administration sort of, for lack of a better word, humored the president up till a point. And they kept thinking the president would eventually let this stuff go. And I think what you see in November and December with both Barr and the folks who testified yesterday is there's a horrible moment of realization when those individuals understand that Trump is not going to let it go.
Well, you know, Claire, I was remembering this was back a couple of years when Jeffrey Sessions, who was the attorney general, recused himself. This had to do with the DOJ Russian investigation. And President Trump said, you know, where is my Roy Cohn? And it seemed as if, and when you look back over the 4 years of him in office, that is how he viewed the Justice Department.
That's right. He expected that the attorney general would be sort of his personal lawyer and that the attorney general was there to defend his administration. And that's just not the way the Justice Department works. And what was extraordinary yesterday was to hear from people who were absolutely committed to the vision of the Justice Department as a fairly independent body there to do justice and to look at the facts and look at the law, and that they were not going to allow the president's, you know, personal desire to win re-election to affect their mandate. That was reassuring, to say the least.
Let me play another clip, and this is a committee member, Republican Representative Adam Kinzinger. He did the questioning yesterday, and here he is asking Richard Donahue, former acting deputy attorney general, about his notes from a meeting he had with former President Trump.
Let's take a look at another one of your notes. You also noted that Mr. Rosen said to Mr. Trump, quote, DOJ can't and won't snap its fingers and change the outcome of the election. How did the president respond to that, sir?
He responded very quickly and said, essentially, that's not what I'm asking you to do. What I'm just asking you to do is just say it was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman.
So let's now put up the notes where you quote the president. As you're speaking to that, he said, the president said, just say the election was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman. So, Mr. Donahue, that's a direct quote from President Trump, correct?
That's an exact quote from the president, yes.
I mean, Devin, that's really shocking. But go ahead. Your thoughts, your reaction.
So it is shocking, and it is a frankly a horrible thing to understand that a president tried to make the Justice Department do. I also think it's worth understanding that it fits into a pattern. The president liked the idea of investigations being publicly announced into his adversaries or political opponents, and he, you know, and I think that is, frankly, a direct outgrowth of how the 2016 campaign went, how he won. And he believed that investigations of his opponents, even if they led nowhere and accomplished nothing, were themselves a kind of victory. And I think that's it. That is a pattern that repeats both in 2016, both in the, you know, Hunter Biden and early 2020 era, and in the post-election era. That is what he wants most of the time.
Well, to you, Claire, and just say it was corrupt and leave the rest to me and Republicans, is that legal?
It's really not. And the thing is that this is not very different from what Trump had been doing all along. In October of 2020, Richard Painter and I filed a criminal Hatch Act complaint against President Donald Trump because of the coercion that he was exerting with respect to other federal officers. Now, the president is normally exempt from the Hatch Act's civil provisions, but under 18 U.S.C. 610, which is called coercion of political activity, the attempt to coerce or threaten federal employees into political activity, including taking a stance on an election matter that was to his benefit, taking a side in a political campaign, in effect, is a criminal violation, among many other possible criminal violations. So we were lodging that complaint as early as October 2020.
But by saying, say it was corrupt, even though it wasn't, is that coercion, Claire?
I think that when you put the whole picture together, that he was putting pressure on members of the federal government, senior leaders in the Justice Department, by threatening to remove them if they did not go along with his view of the election, and replace them with a person who he believed would be more loyal to him on this score. It is a form of illegal pressure to engage in political activity.
Well, we're going to take a very short break, but first we have this breaking news and a historic decision a few moments ago. The U.S. Supreme Court has officially ruled on Dobbs v. Jackson and will allow states to restrict or outright ban abortion at any point during a pregnancy, overturning the 1973 decision made in Roe v. Wade. We will carry on our conversation with our guest, Claire Finkelstein, professor of National Security Law and Philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. Devlin Barrett, staying with us as well, national security reporter for the Washington Post. A lot of news today, but we are continuing our conversation, and we want you to join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been carrying reactions to all the House committee hearings into the insurrection. We are doing that today, talking about yesterday's hearing, which focused on the Department of Justice. And again, our guests are Devlin Barrett, national security reporter for The Washington Post, and Claire Finkelstein, professor of national security law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. Devlin, I was reading a couple of stories about whether members of the Republican Party or the GOP itself has regrets that they did not put, you know, members of their party on this committee. Now, there are two members, both Kinzinger, who we heard today, and also Liz Cheney. But is there some grousing within the GOP about the makeup of the party and whether they're missing out on something?
Oh, yeah. I think there's a lot of grousing on that point internally. And I think for some valid reasons, in the sense that I think the sequence here was that, you know, there was originally a handful of Republicans picked to be on this panel. The Democrats objected to a couple of them. And then the Republicans basically said, well, we won't put any Republicans on this panel. And the only two Republicans who ended up on the panel were two Republicans who are stridently anti-Trump. Right. And that's, you know, an understandable sequence of events. But the reality is most congressional hearings are a kind of weird split screen where one party talks about one set of things and the other party talks about a completely different set of things. And it's almost two dueling realities. That's not what these hearings are. These hearings are about one reality, and that's what Trump and the people around him did to try to prevent Joe Biden from becoming president after Joe Biden won the election. And I think that's been very damaging to Republicans overall. And I think there's a lot of remorse among some Republicans that they allowed that dynamic to take shape.
And most of the witnesses, Claire, have been not just members of the Republican Party, but Republicans loyal to Donald Trump, who either worked in the administration or voted for Trump himself. So it makes for a very different kind of dynamic.
That's right, Marty. And what's extraordinary is how, as I mentioned before, how factual their testimony is. They're not in there trashing Donald Trump and saying how awful he is. They don't even sound like, you know, Michael Cohen. They just are telling their experience. And I think that's the power that yesterday's testimony had. It was just so clearly out of all bounds of the role of the Justice Department, what Donald Trump was expecting, and I think came closer to making out a criminal case against Donald Trump than anything we've heard before.
Devin, let me go back to you because we're going to play a couple of clips about Jeffrey Clark. Give us a thumbnail sketch about who he is, and we'll talk about how he got this, almost got the job of acting attorney general. But who's Jeffrey Clark?
So Jeffrey Clark is an otherwise, you know, until 2020, fairly unremarkable conservative lawyer who worked on environmental cases. He ran the environmental division of the Justice Department. And, you know, people who I've covered the DOJ a long time, people who worked with him, you know, up until that point would have described him as essentially the quiet kid in the back of the classroom. He wasn't anyone that was really a mover or shaker in any way among the senior leadership of the Justice Department. And I think that's in a weird way how he becomes a player, because the Justice Department under both Barr and Rosen were very careful, and they knew, you know, how, you know, bumpy the final days with Trump could be. They just never thought that someone like Jeffrey Clark would add to that bumpiness, and that's caught them by surprise.
And it was Scott Perry, according to yesterday's testimony from Pennsylvania, who introduced Jeffrey Clark to the White House, to President Trump himself. Do I have that right?
Yes, and that alone is very strange. Like, this is a hard thing to explain to people who don't hang out at the Justice Department, but there's no reason that the head of the environmental division should be meeting privately with the president to talk about election issues. Like, it's just very strange. You know, Clark's bosses were flabbergasted when they heard that.
Well, they were pretty furious, Claire, that there was a meeting from someone with the DOJ at the White House talking to the president, and they did not know about it.
Well, that's exactly right. It's hard to understand how out of protocol that is. But for a member of the DOJ to bypass his bosses and go with a sitting congressman to the White House to have a conversation about replacing his boss with him is an extraordinary thing to do, something that is just, as I say, beyond all Justice Department protocol and would really be a firing offense under ordinary circumstances, and something a normal president would never even begin to think that he ought to do, because, of course, his relationship ought to be directly with the attorney general. And even then, there ought to be a fair bit of distance between the White House and the Attorney General so as not to compromise investigations.
Well, let me play another clip. And again, this is a committee. They showed video testimony from Richard Donahue, former acting deputy attorney general and White House counsel Eric Hirschman, recounting the Sunday, January 3rd Oval Office meeting in which they questioned the competence of Jeffrey Clark, who we were just talking about. Then President Trump wanted to install him as the next acting attorney general.
I made the point that Jeff Clark is not even competent to serve as the attorney general. He's never been a criminal attorney. He's never conducted a criminal investigation in his life. He's never been in front of a grand jury, much less a trial jury. And he kind of retorted by saying, well, I've done a lot of very complicated appeals and civil litigation, environmental litigation and things like that. And I said, that's right. You're an environmental lawyer. How about you go back to your office and we'll call you when there's an oil spill? And Pat Cipollone weighed in at one point, our member, saying, you know, that letter that this guy wants to send, that letter is a murder-suicide pact. It's going to damage everyone who touches it. And we should have nothing to do with that letter. I don't ever want to see that letter again.
Devlin, again, another, you know, one of those pretty sort of jaw-dropping videos from yesterday. Cipollone is important. Help us understand why the reference to Cipollone is an important one.
So Pat Cipollone was the White House counsel at that time. And so he's the chief lawyer in the White House representing the White House's interests. And he joins the fateful meeting on January 3rd, and he takes the side of all the Justice Department officials who are arguing against what the president wants to do. When he says it's a murder-suicide pact, what he's really saying, and I think this is an important point that sometimes gets lost in this, obviously what happened here was incredible and alarming and very concerning. But the whole point of all of these lawyers, from Cipollone to Rosen to Donahue, et cetera, is that they're telling the president, this will never work. You think you will change the course of the election. You think you will, or in the terms of, you know, that some of the Democrats use, you think you will commit a coup. You won't, because this is so unbelievable. This is so comically inept and stupid and transparent. It will never fly. And so what they're saying, Cipollone and the others are saying in that meeting is, look, you could have hundreds of resignations within 24 hours at the Justice Department over this. No one is going to believe a letter that Jeff Clark sends to Georgia. It's just not going to work. And at one point, Steve Engel, who is one of the people who has served Trump the longest as president, says to the president, sir, Jeff Clark would be leading a graveyard, meaning there would be, you would have gone through two attorney generals in 4 weeks to produce this letter that no one believes. And I do think it's important to contemplate the possibility that the greatest danger here was not that the letter would be sent. Right. The greatest danger here was probably that someone would lose their will, someone's knees would buckle in the Justice Department, and they just agree to it out of fear, and it would have more credibility. I think this thing was so incredible and so ham-handed throughout that sunlight would have actually defeated the plan quicker than this series of like hushed private meetings.
You mentioned Stephen Engel. Let me play a clip. He's a former assistant attorney general for the Office of Legal Counsel. And here he is describing how he tried to dissuade the president from hiring Jeffrey Clark.
My recollection is that when the president turned to me and said, Steve, you wouldn't leave, would you? I said, Mr. President, I've been with you through four attorneys general, including two acting attorney general, but I couldn't be part of this. And then the other thing that I said was that, look, all anyone is going to sort of think about when they see this, no one is going to read this letter. All anyone is going to think is that you went through two attorneys general in 2 weeks until you found the environmental guy to sign this thing. And so the story is not going to be that the Department of Justice has found massive corruption that would have changed the result of the election. It's going to be the disaster of Jeff Clark. And I think at that point, Pat Cipollone said, yeah, this is a murder-suicide pact, this letter.
Claire, let me go back to you. And when you put together all the things that former President Trump tried to do to overturn the election, going to the courts, you know, pressuring secretaries of state and on and on and on, does that get to this issue of intent, what he intended to do? And does that raise some criminal questions?
Absolutely. So it's very clear what he intended to do, right? He was trying by any means that he possibly could to get the help that he wanted to overturn the election. His goal was very, very simple, namely to stay in power no matter what. And obviously that implicates a lot of ethical issues, but a lot of legal issues too. Now, the worst being, I mentioned Criminal Hatch Act violations, and that had been a longstanding possibility. But the worst is seditious conspiracy, 18 U.S.C. Section 2384, and 115 Section 2384, in which it is a crime to overthrow, put down, or to destroy by force the government of the United States, or to levy war, etc. And this is the crime for which, if Donald Trump were convicted, or even if Congress voted that he had engaged in seditious conspiracy under the 14th Amendment, he would be barred from serving in office again.
Well, you know, Claire, let me just jump in very quickly just to say to our listeners, you're listening to WHYY here in Philadelphia. And picking up on that, Claire, then, I mean, seditious conspiracy. Has that ever happened?
That
has a president ever been charged with seditious conspiracy?
No, a president has never been charged. In fact, not only has no president ever been charged, but this is a charge that has hardly ever been used. It was used against Islamic terrorists years and years ago, and it was used after the Civil War. And indeed, the provision Section 3 of the 14th Amendment was passed after the Civil War to deal with the fact that there were all of these Confederate rebels who had, you know, there was the risk that they would serve in office again, and that provision was meant to bar them from serving in office again. So this is a very rarely used provision, and it would be the most serious of the things that Donald Trump could be charged with and convicted of. There are others, however, as well, such as corruptly attempting to obstruct an official proceeding, since the point of this and what emerged on January 6th was to disrupt the certification of the votes. That was the ultimate purpose that he was trying to get support for. And then finally, conspiracy to defraud the United States is another provision. Now, neither of those last two provisions would implicate the 14th Amendment provision, since that's really limited to the insurrection or seditious conspiracy. But these are all extremely serious crimes. For example, attempting to obstruct an official proceeding could result in 20 years in prison.
Wow. And Devlin, it does raise questions. Obviously, the House committee is a fact-finding committee. They will issue a report at some time, but we've got the DOJ doing their own investigation. And interestingly, earlier this week, they did raid the house of Jeffrey Clark, apparently took out some electronic devices. But what do we, and there were some subpoenas that the DOJ issued this week at all. What, if anything, do we know about their investigation into the insurrection and obviously events leading up to that?
So, Marty, I think it's important to understand that Wednesday is actually quite an important moment in this investigation. The January 6th investigation has a bunch of prongs to it at this point. It grew out of the violence of that particular day, but there's now, you know, very unique separate tracks of the investigation. And Wednesday was in large part, but not entirely, a series of subpoenas, search warrants, and interviews around the country.
Yep.
But primarily looking at this issue of false electors, one of the ways in which Trump tried to undo the results of the 2020 election was Trump supporters tried to create alternate slates of electors in key states that Trump had lost, and just sort of essentially submit those names instead of the electors that Biden had won for those states, and see if that would work, see if they could convince either Congress or state legislators to embrace the sort of what many people call false electors. So you saw a whole bunch of subpoenas go out to people who were involved in that effort after the 2020 election. And that's really important because it shows the degree to which this is not just about the people who attacked Congress on that day or the people who, you know, sort of set the wheels in motion for that attack to take place on Congress. That is about a much essentially what you might think of as a paper crime, a potential paper crime of, creating these false elector slates and trying to trick, I guess, someone in political circles into going for that.
And Devlin, that was part of the letter that was going to be sent to Georgia, correct?
Right. And I was just going to say, and that's where Jeffrey Clark comes back into the picture as the Justice Department official who is trying to give credence in late December and early January to this notion that there is somehow significant fraud that needs to be re-examined by state legislatures. And you can see, I think one of the things the committee has done well is you can see how these different tracks meet up or interact with each other, right? Because Clark's letter is designed to sort of create the circumstances for those false elector slates to suddenly become relevant and viable. It doesn't work, obviously, but that was the idea.
Well, and even going to the courts, and we're almost coming to break here, Devlin, I think 60 times, I think there was one time out of 60 that a court actually believed or agreed with the Trump campaign. I mean, all the attempts to undo the election results didn't work, but it seems like we came perilously close.
It was in many ways, it was a comically inept scheme because as Rudy Giuliani was quoted as saying at one of these hearings, you know, we have lots of theories, but we don't have any evidence.
Right.
And I have to say, as someone who's covered trial attorneys for a long time, that's an amazing admission. Like, I think non-lawyers probably don't realize how incredible of a self-own that is. But that was their approach, but they had no evidence for it. And what they were really trying to do was, you know, sort of trick or just by force of will and personality alone gets one of these things to fly somewhere.
Sure. Well, a very short break and then we'll be right back. Do stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about what we learned from yesterday's hearing about former President Trump's efforts to use the DOJ to stay in power. That's the Department of Justice. What we know about the DOJ's investigation, whether Trump broke any laws. Talking with Claire Finkelstein, professor of national security law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us, Devlin Barrett. He is national security reporter for The Washington Post. Let me play another clip, and this is Richard Donahue, former acting deputy attorney general, explaining that he would leave his position if Jeff Clark was hired and that others would follow. And again, this is at this showdown meeting that was held at the White House on January 3rd.
Along those lines, he said, so suppose I do this. So suppose I replace him, Jeff Rosen, with him, Jeff Clark. What would you do? And I said, Mr. President, we resign immediately. I'm not working one minute for this guy, who I had just declared was completely incompetent. And so the president immediately turned to Mr. Engel, and he said, Steve, you wouldn't resign, would you? And he said, absolutely, I would, Mr. President. You leave me no choice. And I said, Mr. President, within 24, 48, 72 hours, you could have hundreds and hundreds of resignations of the leadership of your entire Justice Department because of your actions. What's that going to say about you?
And Claire, you know, has some memories of the Saturday night special during a Saturday night massacre, I should say, during the whole Watergate scandal. Obviously, President Trump did not do what he wanted to do, but nonetheless, he certainly considered it.
Right. And it's really extraordinary, Marty, when you look at the fact that Trump had been able to press his will in so many ways, bend the law, twist the law. And here he was not able to. Why? Because the senior leadership of the Department of Justice spoke very clearly and with one voice, as well as White House counsel, Pat Cipollone. And it shows how powerless, really, even a very corrupt president is when senior officials are absolutely clear that he has gone too far and stick to their guns on that. He really couldn't proceed because of the comment that Donahue made about Jeffrey Clark would be presiding over a graveyard. There'd be no Department of Justice. And that would really gut the administration, given the role that the Justice Department plays. Trump couldn't replace them fast enough, and so he couldn't use the Department of Justice in the way that he had hoped. And that's a lesson from Watergate. Of course, the person who eventually fired Archibald Cox was none other than Robert Bork, who went on to have the failed appointment to the Supreme Court, failed nomination to the Supreme Court that did not get through. But there were several, you know, attorneys general, acting attorneys general, who refused to fire the special counsel. And that really hobbled Nixon's attempt to, you know, cover up his crimes and attack the investigation that Cox was engaged in.
And Devlin, it does raise questions about just the mood, the atmosphere at the DOJ at this time when there was so much incoming and so many, you know, false allegations. And as we learned, you know, lots of following up on, you know, things like satellites from Italy that were undoing votes. But what was the mood inside the DOJ at that time?
Well, it changed pretty drastically from, I would say, early November to late December and early January. And I think in November, there was a general view among a lot of folks at the Justice Department that, you know what, this is going to be bumpy, but it'll be fine. We will look into allegations. And, you know, they usually don't pan out because most instances of voter fraud are extremely small scale. But we will, you know, do our due diligence and check. And at some point in late November, it becomes clear to the senior Justice Department officials that just telling the president they're checking on these things, however crazy a set of allegations the president keeps pushing to them, is not satisfying the president. And he's escalating, essentially. And so what you get from, say, through the month of December is an ingrowing sense of concern and alarm within the Justice Department about the president's demands getting more and more intense, and how to, and Justice Department officials trying to figure out how to navigate that. And Donahue at one point decides to just put it all on the table and just sort of emphatically say to the president, this isn't true, this isn't true, this isn't true, in the hopes that it will sink in. But he admits that, you know, even after that very long conversation, he didn't think the president was convinced at all. And so it's just a very stressful, worrisome time for them.
I mean, it's clear, a pattern, Claire, of the president just finding people to tell him what he wanted to believe and give them as much power and authority as he possibly could.
Right. But the point is that the resistance works. And the interesting thing about the Department of Justice having preserved its integrity is you then find this letter from Representative Mo Brooks seeking preemptive pardons for 147 members of Congress. Now, you think that would have happened if the Justice Department had caved? Probably not, right? So this, what this really is an admission of guilt and an expression of fear that all of those individuals, including members of Congress, were going to be prosecuted for their role in trying to overturn the election.
Well, let's play a montage. It's about a minute and a half, picking up, Claire, on what you just said there. This is playing video depositions from the White House counsel and aides, showing a number of Republican lawmakers, including Mo Brooks of Alabama, Matt Gaetz of Florida, Andy Biggs of Arizona, Louie Gohmert of Texas, Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, sought preemptive pardons for their roles in the effort to overturn the 2020 election.
Are you aware of any members of Congress seeking pardons?
I guess Mr. Gaetz and Mr. Brooks, I know, both advocated for there to be a blanket pardon for members involved in that meeting and a handful of other members that weren't at the December 21st meeting as the preemptive pardons. Mr. Gaetz was personally pushing for a pardon, and he was doing so since early December. I'm not sure why. Mr. Gaetz had reached out to me to ask if he could have a meeting with Mr. Meadows about receiving a presidential pardon.
Did they all contact you?
Not all of them, but several of them did.
So you mentioned Mr. Gaetz, Mr. Brooks.
Mr. Biggs did. Mr. Jordan talked about congressional pardons, but he never asked me for one. It was more for an update on whether the White House is going to pardon members of Congress. Mr. Gohmert asked for one as well.
And
Mr. Perry asked for a pardon too. I'm sorry, I need to finish.
Mr. Perry, did he talk to you directly?
Yes, he did.
Did Marjorie Taylor Greene contact you?
No, she didn't contact me about it. I heard that she had asked White House Counsel Office for a pardon from Mr. Philbin, but I didn't frequently communicate with Ms. Green.
That's a long list, Evelyn. People wanting pardons.
Yeah, and it speaks to, again, I'm struck by the sort of absurdity. If you look at the email that Mo Brooks wrote to the White House, he wanted a pardon of not just a large number of people, but a very broad definition of conduct that is really sort of not how pardons work. A lot of, you know, all through this period, you again and again and again come across Trump folks trying to do something where you think the easiest answer should be, yeah, sorry, that's not how any of this works. And the pardons was definitely part of that. But I think what's so telling to me about the pardons is the folks who are asking them clearly envision like some sort of possibility of criminal exposure, and also envision a world in which they have some reason to believe that Trump will protect them before he leaves. I think both of those things are really grim parts of this whole saga.
But, I mean, Trump did issue some pardons, as other presidents do, but did he pardon any of these people?
No, he did not. He pardoned, you know, people who had been convicted who were former aides of his. Right. And, you know, there's a lot of anger and upset over those. He issued a lot of pardons that I think you could fairly say were for political allies. But he did not issue what you might think of as anything that you might call a January 6th pardon.
Claire, I heard someone compare asking for a pardon like taking the Fifth. Do you see it that way? I mean, is it some, if not an admission of guilt, suddenly a concern about guilty behavior or criminal behavior?
I think it's much more significant than taking the Fifth. If you take the Fifth, it's about the proceeding that you're in. or the fear that you may be in, but it's not an admission of guilt. Whereas taking a pardon, asking for a pardon and taking one if granted, is an admission of guilt. It is directly that. It means that you have committed a crime for which you are requesting a pardon. Now, Donald Trump, if they had really thought it through, they would have realized he was almost certainly not going to give a pardon to anyone who could be construed as involved in a conspiracy that would implicate him. And this is one of them. So the January, I mean, Trump was well aware that evidence becomes clearer and clearer that he could possibly be subjected to criminal charges because of his conduct in the run-up to January 6th, and particularly on January 6th, but coming out of the meeting on the 3rd relating to Jeffrey Clark as well. And he was not going to grant a pardon that would constitute an admission of culpability to people who might be part of the very same conspiracy and seditious conspiracy that he could be charged with.
And is it true that if you get a pardon, you can't take the Fifth, Claire?
Well, that's right, because then you don't have any further exposure. Right. So that when you take the Fifth, you're saying, I cannot testify or I cannot speak to this issue because it may implicate me in the sense of exposing me to future criminal liability. If you've been pardoned, you have no exposure to future criminal liability. So it would have been, in some ways, a very damning thing to do, especially a pardon of the breadth that was being requested here. And let's also highlight the fact that these were not only blanket, very general and broad pardons that were being requested, but preemptive pardons, because there were no criminal charges or even a criminal investigation on the horizon when this letter was written.
Devlin, Judge Carter said a couple of months ago, he talked about the, quote, illegality of the plan is obvious. This is to obstruct the congressional counting of electoral votes. More likely than not, committed a federal crime in obstructing the congressional count. How significant is what Judge Carter said?
Yeah, I got to be honest. I think that finding is a little overblown in the public space for this reason. That was a part of an argument about access to emails and evidence. And so there was basically a discussion of what sort of premise would justify looking at that material. And the judge laid out a premise. Now the judge's assertion is that there's more likely than not that a crime was committed. That is that is certainly an important finding, considering
Indeed.
What we're talking about and the stakes. But I think you have to understand that you have to keep in mind that's a civil standard, not a criminal standard. And I also think you have to keep in mind that, you know, the fact that that judge says that is sort of buttresses the ongoing investigation into all these issues. Right. There is an investigation into exactly who was involved in all this. But I don't think a judge saying that in the context of a civil fight over evidence tells us ultimately a lot about what the Justice Department will do in the criminal space.
Let me play one more clip, and this is Liz Cheney in closing statements from yesterday's hearing. She made an appeal to voters who still support President Trump, believe that the election is stolen. Let's give it a quick listen.
It can be difficult to accept that President Trump abused your trust, that he deceived you. Many will invent excuses to ignore that fact. But that is a fact. I wish it weren't true, but it is.
Claire, we have about 45 seconds before we have to end the hour. Just final thoughts from you.
Well, I think that this hearing was a turning point, potentially a turning point in public opinion, but clearly a turning point for the Justice Department. So now the really big issue is, number one, is there going to be a criminal referral from the commission? And number two, what is Merrick Garland going to do with this? But clearly, a momentum has picked up. The Justice Department requested broad access to the January 6th Commission's findings and evidence. I hope that the Commission is not in any way hesitant about sharing that information I heard an interview with Adam Schiff in which there was some question about that. I think the commission needs to share everything they can with the Justice Department and hope that the Justice Department moves appropriately.
Well, we have to end our discussion, and I should add that the hearings will commence in sometime in July. Claire Finkelstein, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me,
Marty. You're welcome. And she's a professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. Devlin Barrett, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. National security reporter for The Washington Post. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.